Today is Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. This is Chris Kretz for the Stony Brook University Libraries interviewing Judy Greiman for the Documenting COVID-19 Stony Brook University Experiences Project over Zencastr. Judy, first of all, thank you for sharing your memories with us.
Absolutely. Happy to.
And can we start? Can you tell us your position at Stony Brook and how long you've been at the university?
I'm the chief deputy to the president and also the senior vice president for government and community relations. And I've been here for just about 5.5 years.
Okay. And in broad strokes, what would you say your general areas of activity are?
Everything.
Very broad.
I mean, on the government relations side, it's sort of all government, overseeing of all government community relations at the state, federal, and local levels. And on the deputy side, it's really serving as the president's right-hand person. And, I run a vice president's council. I oversee a bunch of areas, including Title IX and conferences and events, and but mostly it's around strategic and policy matters for the president.
Great. So if we think back to the start of the spring 2020 semester, what were you working on? Was there something, what was on the radar then before the pandemic came into view that you were working on?
I actually, among, sort of the day-to-day, we were in the midst of a presidential search. So Stony Brook was looking for a new president. We had an interim president in place at the time, and we were trying to bring to a close soon the search for the new president. That was probably one of the single most important things. And we also had a legislative session that was right in front of us that we knew would be a tough one.
And so when do you remember first being aware of COVID, and what were your initial thoughts on it?
I'm actually not sure when I was aware of it sort of in the world. I'm very clear when I was aware of it here, which was probably mid-February, where we knew something was going on in the world. And and we knew that things were amping up in other parts of the world, particularly in Italy. And we had study abroad students. We had study abroad students, and SUNY had study abroad students in Europe and elsewhere. And as we rounded into the first week in March, it became clear that it was important to get those students back to the U.S. And so the first week in March, I was actually, oddly enough, at a crisis management leadership in higher ed crisis management seminar for 4 days at Harvard. And while everybody else was inside the classroom, sort of wondering, what is this virus? What is this thing? Should we make changes to our commencement? Can we shake hands? That was kind of the conversation. I was outside in the hallway almost the entire time, managing the bringing the study abroad students back to New York and to our Stony Brook Southampton campus for quarantining. And so kind of managing the political issues around that, the logistical issues around that, et cetera. And from that point forward, it hasn't stopped.
Yeah. We've talked to a few people on that aspect, the Southampton camp, the use of that. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? How many students actually came and what you had to do to house them?
So I think there were, I think in the end, either we had space for 30 something or there were 30 something that actually came. It was a, complicated dance, working with SUNY, working with the Office of the Governor, working with our own students and families. Almost none of the students that came here were our students. They were students from FIT and can't remember where else. And, you know, the Residence Life people did an amazing job of basically creating a quarantine dorm, you know, buying refrigerators for, and yoga mats for every room, and making sure that there were things set up that made sense for people who are going to have to quarantine for 2 weeks. Remember, this was literally the beginning of it here. Nobody even understood what does it mean to quarantine for 2 weeks. And, you know, sort of having to figure out all of the details around how do we get their medical needs met? How do we get their academic needs met? How do we manage students who might not want to be in those rooms? So all that was going on with mostly student life, but there was a political side of it, which was that the local community saw this as Stony Brook bringing the virus to Long Island. Now the virus was already on Long Island, but their view of it was that we were at fault for bringing the virus to Long Island. And so there was quite a bit of managing with the local politicians, the local community activists, SUNY, the governor's folks around, you know, what was actually happening and how were we going to manage it.
And so as it developed, when did it dawn, or when did you start seeing that the main campus would be affected and further steps would be taken?
We were already working at that moment. It just, that was kind of the moment that sort of, I would say that week was the kind of the moment that just sort of crystallized it all. And we, you know, really came to understand, okay, this is a real deal for us and we need to, you know, all hands on deck. You know, but that week, which is, you know, hard to fathom at the moment, we were still, as a leadership team, all in the same room. And we were also thinking through, well, we had the Stony Brook Gala, which is a once a year major event, usually 900 people squeezed into a very big event space in Manhattan. Were we going to go ahead with that? With many people that first week saying, of course we're going to go ahead with that. We had the Staller Center had its major gala. So 900 people in the Staller Center, were we going to go ahead with that? And so, and then we had women's basketball championships. And so, you know, each of these kind of each, so everything else was going on in terms of what's really happening, how are we going to manage it with our students, et cetera. But there were these three events that were also kind of, I mean, you can almost do a study of each day in that first week as we approach these three events, right? And so can we do basketball? Well, you know, we can't cancel one thing and not cancel another thing, right? And so how do we do that? And I think that basketball made it to the penultimate game. I think we either reduced or took away the fans. And then I think it was the NCAA or America East stopped it. The Staller Gala, we agreed to let the concert go on, but not the pre and post parties go on, because the concert, you know, there was a judgment made that you'd just be sitting in a chair as opposed to mingling and hugging and sharing food. The gala we canceled, but again, each day was a conversation about these things and what was the right thing to do. You know, by the time we canceled the gala, which I believe was supposed to be March 9th, you know, there was no question what was happening and everybody was, you know, we weren't talking about events anymore. We were talking about how are we going to move our students off the campus and what are we doing? So.
You mentioned the team, or do you want to talk a little about the people you were working with most directly who were in the room with you there?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that Larry Zacharys, now interim chief of police, but head of emergency management, and I kind of led the effort. And then there were a whole range of other players. I mean, Nicholas Cabetta was at the time the VP for marketing and communications. He was actively engaged. Legal, Susan Plum, was actively engaged. Finance was actively engaged. Student Affairs, Rick Atto, Kathy Byington. Technology, Charlie McMahon. So, you know, it was kind of like an all hands on deck leadership team. We needed to get the deans engaged. And we had, again, we had an interim president. So the interim president, who had been the provost, which was useful because we had an interim provost. There's a lot of interims happening during all this. And so the interim president was, was a piece of that. And then over all of that was the presidential search was coming to a head, coming to a close. And so we knew that we would have an incoming president who would have to pretty much, even though that person wouldn't be coming until July, that person would have to immediately get engaged. And so, you know, that was kind of another person who wasn't yet in the room, but was about to be in the room.
So I'm impressed. How do you prioritize with that list of issues to deal with? What were you most worried about, or what was your guiding principles as you worked through it all?
You know, I mean, we had guiding principles, which were really around, the thing that I haven't added yet was what was happening in our hospital. So while all this is happening, we obviously had, you know, the rest of the country was still saying what's going on, but here we knew the virus was here and we had a hospital that was, you know, exploding with cases. And so that began, a roller coaster ride through the world of PPE and management of state, local, and federal health officials and, staffing and getting executive orders so we could shift medical personnel from whatever they're licensed for to COVID-related care. So, you know, all of that was also going on that we were sort of helping to, Larry and I were sort of helping to manage and oversee. So how do you prioritize? You just keep going. each day we'd have certain things that we knew we had to get done. And each day we'd have 27 unexpected things happening. But, we did them.
So maybe if we stick with the West Campus for a minute and with spring break looming, what were the steps you had to take to address what would happen during and after spring break?
I mean, we had to figure out, is this what we're doing? So, right. Are we at the point where we need to send people home? And having gotten there, okay, fine. Then what does that actually mean? So if we're not, we know that some of our students aren't going to be able to go home. They're international, they're homeless, they're whatever. And so we needed to figure out a way to serve their needs. That was really important. We needed to figure out a way for them to signal that they needed to stay and had to create a system for that. Meeting their needs meant, you can't just shut down your dining hall. You can't just not have student health. You needed all that stuff. And so we needed to make sure that that was happening. You know, we needed to make sure that students were leaving, but were they leaving for the whole semester? Were they leaving just for 2 weeks? It was sort of, it was still up in the air for a little bit until kind of the very end. And then there was a whole range of stuff around technology. So if you're sending people home forever, then what about our students who don't have laptops and, devices, or who don't have good intranet? And so, there was already a lot of work being done around that to kind of figure that piece out. Clearly, we knew our finances were going to take a hit. Clearly, we knew that, our auxiliaries, our FSA that does our food service and other things was going to take a hit. And so we just kind of needed to figure all of that out. You know, every day was, you know, more, there were kind of a variety of committees that began to meet. There were daily, you know, I don't know if it was 8 or 8:30, there were daily calls in the morning, there were daily calls in the afternoon, there were leadership calls on other times. There were kind of committees that continued to form around research, because we had to shut down all the labs at that time and what that would mean around, you know, research around student affairs, around technology, health. So we just began to kind of create. And then another thing that was actually happening that was kind of the beautiful bright spot in all this was that people began to want to donate to us. And so we had some people who were tasked to figure that out, and they created a system and, you know, basically took over the entire Wong Center. And we had a distribution drop-off and distribution center in the Wong Center. And, you know, they had to put in place the kinds of things that we would take and who would accept them and how we would accept them and then how we would get them distributed. Most of the stuff was for the hospital, but how we would distribute it, what we would do to you know, make sure that the needs were being met. And so that was kind of a whole other piece that was happening during all this.
And what types of things were coming in? What types of donations?
Masks. So there was a whole group of called the Stony Brook Stitchers that began to sew masks endlessly, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of masks. There were, that were great, very colorful. There were other people who were working their connections to find N95s, whether they be from other countries. There were people who were donating meals. And so, you know, they'd want to donate meals for a shift of nurses or something. There were people, I mean, there were some sweet days. So around Easter, there were, I think it was like some of the pharmacies, maybe it was Duane Reade or something, donated tons of chocolate, like bunnies, you know, Easter candy, because it wasn't selling because nobody was going into stores. And a nursery donated a bunch of Easter flowers. I'm talking thousands, you know. And so the team that was managing all the donations went to in front of the hospital at a shift change and just had everything laid out. And as you changed your shift, you got a chocolate basket and you got flowers, and sort of the staff coming out of what was really an increasingly, you know, difficult place to be, to watch so many sick people, you know, got to come out and see this, you know, chocolate and bunnies and flowers. And it was really nice to be able to do. So it was a wide range of things that were donated. Hand sanitizer. Could you- and then there was also some, you know, in our quest to get PPE, we also had people stepping up. So the chemistry department began to create hand sanitizer, and folks in iCreate began to make face shields, all this for the hospital. And, you know, so, you know, there's a team in engineering that was beginning to try and figure out how do you do a low cost, practically parts from, you know, a Home Depot ventilator, and they did it actually. So, you know, all of that was part of the donation effort.
Could you talk a little more about what you were seeing at the hospital and the challenges they faced? You've alluded to some of them, but
I think the biggest, you know, obviously it was in almost what felt like moments, they had to retool. And they had to, so the governor required a mandated an expansion of capacity by about 100%, I think it was. And so you had to, you know, repurpose areas that weren't set up for patient care. We were lucky in that we had just opened the new bed tower. And so we actually had patient rooms in the old hospital that were unused at that time. They hadn't yet been renovated. And so, you know, we were opening beds everywhere, but PPE was a major issue. It was really, really difficult in terms of gowns and masks and gloves at different times. Swabs, there was a whole issue about getting swabs for testing. And so a lot of that was helping the hospital to kind of work all of our connections at the state, federal, and local levels. At one point, because of the gown situation had become terrible, I'm sure if you talk to Carol Gomes, you'll hear about this, but you know, the head of the hospital decided we just need to make our own gowns and found a window manufacturer who could stamp out with a high-tech tool gowns from plastic sheeting. And then we'd get people to sit at the in the Health Sciences Center and use Tyvek tape to make gowns. And that went on for many, 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 many months. Because she had been unable to secure the proper impermeable gowns. And she said, I can't be in a situation where I can't protect my workers, and so we'll just make our own. So that kind of stuff was happening at the hospital. Clearly, ventilators was a difficult situation for a while. You know, staffing became an issue. And then the other thing that was happening, just to add one more thing, was that the governor's office decided to build field hospitals in various places, and they selected Stony Brook University. And so they built 5 massive tents and built full on, took over our fields and, you know, full on massive the shells, the structures for field hospital. They were never used, but the structures continue to be there. And so that was a whole situation going on while everything else was happening that our facilities folks had to be involved with, hospital folks had to be involved with, Larry and I were involved with certainly. So that was sort of a daily thing for quite a while as those were getting built. We had the Army Corps of Engineers here. We had FEMA here. So there was just a swirl of activity everywhere.
So just in terms of my basic question is what the campus felt like, but were you jumping through all these different areas? Were you like in watching the hospital go up? I mean, the field hospitals, were you moving around campus or were you sort of coordinating from a command center?
There were other people who were moving around. I mean, I was in one room for almost, you know, March, April, May, June. I don't think I saw the light of day because you'd get in super early and leave super late. And there are no windows in that room. it was kind of the command center.
So how did you keep mind your own health during this time?
There kind of wasn't time. I mean, I am a pretty even keeled person, luckily, because there were a lot of dark and difficult moments. I was going to say, I forgot something before, but obviously the hospital also had to figure out how to deal with its, how to expand its morgue capacity. And that was a whole thing as well, in terms of figuring out how do you do that? What's the best way to do that? How do you do that with the most respect? Different situation. But, you know, I needed to keep my wits about me. And Larry and I sort of both needed to be the strongest people for everybody else. So we would certainly try and be supportive of each other. One of the things that I did was to bring tons of healthy snacks for everybody. There were very few people on campus, and there were maybe 10 people in the admin building, but they'd know that there'd always be food up there. So they would, you know, drop by for snacks. Every Monday, I'd snack up the room. We knew we didn't have really time to stop and take time. We needed to keep going.
And what about dealing with the stress itself? Did you have anything that you could distract yourself with or take downtime pieces?
The good news is that in January of this year, I did a 30-day yoga challenge, and every morning I was doing yoga, and I kept that up through the whole thing. So that was helpful. And every now and then when something really crappy happened, I would take a very fast, very long walk around the campus, and that would help.
Can you say a little bit more about how you were interacting with externally with the different levels of authorities and governments? Just maybe some more about those relationships.
Sure. I mean, you know, Larry mostly handled the county health folks. I was on the both the politician front and the kind of state level. We had some federal politicians who were helping, but state level folks at SUNY and then the governor's office working with them to try and, for example, a lot of time spent trying to secure the PPE, a lot of time spent around the field hospitals, and then a lot of time spent around managing SUNY's response, because we were often ahead of where SUNY was, in part because we've got a bigger group of students, or, you know, we're just a very different campus, the research component. So we were often, we knew we had developed the plan to sort of figure out how to manage whatever this is, you know, research, taking students off campus, getting technology to them, whatever the thing was. And so we would have to work very closely then with SUNY to make sure that the plans that they were putting out or the rules that they were putting out didn't conflict. So did a lot of that. We often needed some help with executive orders. So for example, the hospital needed to, I think I said this earlier, needed to change, needed to get some reduction in liability for docs who are licensed in one specialty, but now we needed them to do COVID care. And so there were executive orders happening like every other day, where the governor would sort of say, for the bulk of COVID time, this law doesn't apply, or, you know, docs and nurses are indemnified from liability if we're asking them to do COVID care, and that's not their usual work. So I spent, you know, a lot of time with folks, particularly in the governor's office or in SUNY, around those kinds of things as well. A lot of talks about PPE.
Did that ever get any better during the course of the last 8 months or so? Was there a stabilization of PPE, or?
I mean, it only really got better when Long Island cases began to come down. So it's not that, oh, and we haven't even discussed. And then there was one other thing happening on this campus, which is that the state chose us to be the Suffolk County place for testing. And so there was quite a bit of work going on, and my team was working very closely with the government people around setting up the PLOT coronavirus testing site, managing that on a day-to-day basis. We also at the same time created a kind of pre-emergency room triage site there with our docs. So all that was going on, and there were a lot of PPE issues around that as well. But really, PPE stuff did not calm down until the cases calmed down. And we already know that there are going to be shortages in the coming surge. So, you know, we tried in the time that it was calm to find every possible way on our own to stockpile PPE so that we would be ready for a second surge. And not to have to rely on the state, federal, or local governments to get it to us.
And just to go back to the PLOT, so who was staffing that, those drive-in testing?
Well, the PLOT is, so the Stony Brook sort of pre-ER was run by Dr. Josh Miller from Stony Brook Medicine. And then the PLOT testing is run by the state DEC and DOH, and but Michael Ahrens, who's on my team, government relations, was kind of the liaison to the university, and helped to managed because, you know, every now and then there'd be bumps in the road around who was paying for what and how campus property was being used and things like that. And so Michael was kind of the go-to person.
Okay. And looking back, what was one of the more surprising sources of help or collaborations that you found?
I mean, it was, you know, I have to say some of the donation stuff was just sort of heartwarming in a lot of ways. I mean, kids did videos for nurses and, you know, made cards that were plastered all over. I mean, so that kind of stuff was just like, okay, there's a world out there that, you know, cares about what we're doing. And that was very nice. You know, I think that it was complicated. I actually don't want to dive into this, but you know, some of the partners that you thought that were there at the state level were often more complicated in terms of the partnership. So that was difficult. I mean, I guess the other thing I would say is that who we relied on were, this place rocked. I mean, people at Stony Brook stepped up in ways that were amazing. You know, we needed to create, we had no employee health apparatus on West Campus, and we needed to have a health information line that our employees could call if they had questions, if they'd been, thought that they'd been exposed, if they themselves had come down with the virus. And we put that together in like 24 hours, right? I mean, our student health just did amazing work and then continued to as we created testing for students. You know, Res Life, astonishing. So, I mean, I think that, well, it didn't surprise me actually, because I think that Stony Brook people are incredible and dedicated and devoted to what they do. But it was wonderful to see this team, this broader team of people who are here, just stepping up in every possible way.
Was there anything that you thought would be a bigger problem or issue that turned out to be not so?
Well, I think that although nobody likes Zoom, and I think the classes first, you know, at the end of the semester last year weren't necessarily our best. I think that they went off with less of a hitch than I would have expected, right? I mean, professors pivoted in such an immediate way, and they did okay. And, you know, our students got through the semester. So that was, you know, I think I expected that to be a bit rockier than it actually was.
And just since we're still, you know, in going through this, coming back in the fall or bringing the students back in the fall, what sticks out in your mind about the challenges of that as you were planning it?
You know, we had a very elaborate plan. We knew, we felt that we could make our plan work. It had about no more than 25% of on-ground classes. We knew we could take, well, we knew we could take at least 6,000 in their dorms, so we got about 4,500. And so we knew we had massive financial challenges, but the challenge really was to make sure that we could do all that and keep everybody healthy. And, you know, that was our goal, was to keep everybody healthy and safe, and to make sure that our students had the opportunity to progress to degree, because that's what they need, and that they continue to stay engaged in this institution. And I think we had an extraordinary plan. I think we had incredible people working that plan, and we're one of, you know, I think not a lot of institutions in this country who we stayed open the 13 weeks of our plan that we needed to. I have a calendar on my door that shows each day that we needed to be open, and we put a red mark on it every day at 5, and Friday's got a smiley face, and I will donate it to the library because it's very special. But, you know, every day we looked at that calendar, how many weeks we have left, what do we need to do to keep this going? And we made it. So we had fewer than 100 cases over the course of the whole semester from our students. That's pretty incredible for an institution this size. But there's a lot of planning and a lot of effort that went into making it.
Just as a summation, in case I haven't asked you a particular question, what is there anything you would like people to know about this time and what you experienced during it?
Now I'm getting emotional. It was the challenge of a lifetime, I think, for individuals and for this institution. And we came together, you know. So, I mean, you know, what's a seawolf? I'm a seawolf. I mean, we were all in this, from our students, our faculty, our, you know, university senate, our leadership, our interim president, our incoming president, right? We were in this, and we had a single focus on the health and safety of our students, staff, and faculty, and our patients and patient care. And, you know, it's, I think, remarkable the things that we managed to do on both sides of Nichols Road and the things that we will continue to do until this virus burns itself out. Really an incredible team of people. Every obstacle that could come before us, we jumped over and kept going. So that's what I got.
Great. Well, we thank you for all that work and for sharing that with us, and we appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for doing this.